95 BFM News Election Coverage 2020, Foreign Affairs.
Now, Minister Martin was unavailable to speak to us today. However, I do have here in studio Rob Gore, the party's candidate for New Lynn. How are you doing?
Ata Mario, doing very well, thank you.
Yeah, and you used to also be the lead youth organiser for the party's youth wing.
Yes, I was.
So you've been in it for a while.
Yeah, for probably about the past 5 years. It was September 25th, 2015, patched over in a Green Lane McDonald's. A good friend at university at the time dragged me kicking and screaming, and since then I've never really looked back. So I spent 3 years chairing Young New Zealand First on this campus where we first got started, and then elected onto the board of directors, and now I'm a candidate for the party in New Lynn. So it's quite a journey.
Good to be back on your old stomping ground back at Auckland Uni.
Definitely it is.
Right, so we're going to be talking about some topics relating to foreign policy today, namely New Zealand First's policy regarding the rural visa, removing the right to vote for permanent residents, and a bit about defence funding. So if we were to start with the rural visa, my understanding is this would create a legal obligation on foreign workers to stay in the specified place of settlement until they then become a citizen. And they would be restricted to communities of less than 100,000 people, such as Nelson or New Plymouth or Invercargill, to name a few. So is my understanding of that correct? Is that
Sort of. So let's not forget that this isn't a novel idea. So this has been done in Australia through the regional sponsored migration scheme, and it's been done in Canada as well through the rural and northern immigration pilot in Canada. And when people look at it, they go, oh, you're bonding a migrant to a certain place and you're restricting them. That's not actually what it's about. What it's about is creating a certain clear pathway for that person to go into residency. We have a problem at the moment where our immigration system isn't very well planned, it isn't very well targeted, and as a result, we're letting a whole lot of people fall through the cracks. We're dangling this carrot of permanent residency, and in the process, we've created this second-class tier of workers in this country through migrant labour, and we haven't put in the labour enforcement rules to actually protect those people. So what this rural visa scheme does is one of two things. So first of all, it's about planning. So we know that in these regional communities, there's a huge issue around declining populations, an ageing population, and a lack of skill shortages. Whereas in other areas, for example, like Christchurch, Queenstown, and Auckland, there's a huge population increase. A smart strategic immigration system is one that addresses the skill shortages that we need across the country. And the labour needs and labour markets of a place like Napier, Hastings or Tokoroa is going to be a little bit different to the labour needs and market and population makeup of a place like Auckland. So
I think it's interesting that you bring up that specifically, the kinds of jobs they'll be doing, because I understand that New Zealand's First's insistence is that if migrants are going to be coming in, then we need them to be skilled. But isn't that the case that, I mean, a lot of the skilled work is in these large cities?
To a degree. I mean, the first thing to remember is this, is that only 3% of new residents actually come in on an absolute skill shortage. So for a long time, we've been given this promise that our immigration system is going to deliver us greater innovation, greater productivity, greater levels of employment and economic growth. And that's not actually on the individual migrants. They're just coming here for a better life for themselves. But the flip side of that is, because our immigration system is so poorly designed, the people with the skills that we actually want don't end up staying there, because we're not putting the wraparound support and pathway to permanent residency. We need to keep them. In terms of a country of attracting immigration, we do very well. In terms of retaining those people, holding on to their skills and their contribution, we do very poorly. That's exactly what this rural visa scheme is about. It's not about taking someone from away from Auckland and throwing them into the regions into the ether. It's actually about creating a permanent pathway where a community is crying out for their help, that can put the wraparound support for them and say, look, if you're a livestock veterinarian, or you've got a particular skill set around a horticultural machine technician or operation that we can't find any New Zealanders employable or trainable, here's this community that really wants to take hold of you, wraparound support for you, and at the same time, here's this pathway to become a permanent resident in our country. The flip side at the moment is that we're saying, look, you can study here, or you can work here, or you come here on a work holiday visa, and maybe just one day, you might have the full rights and entitlements of a New Zealand citizen. But obviously that's not what's happened, and we've got horrific rates of migrant exploitation at the moment. And that's a result of that system. You look at other systems like Turkey and Germany, where they've tried the guest worker system, and it hasn't actually created a guest worker, it's created a slave worker. That is not the direction we want for our immigration system in this country.
Yeah, and I guess aside from the can or should we do this, how do you logistically enforce that? I mean, how do you make sure that somebody stays put in one place and doesn't move?
So you police it in the same way that we currently police international students, which in full honesty actually needs a bit more work than we currently do. But we already have restrictions on what kind of working rights people already have. So with holiday student visas, you're allowed to work for 12 months out of the 2 years that you're here. For international students, you're able to work 20 hours per week. It's a mix of custodianship and actually looking after the migrant, because it's not just about you have to stay here. It's about having the wraparound support for that person within that community. That's going to be the biggest reason they remain in that community more than anything else. The enforcement part is the stick. And the same way we enforce the current rules around international students is the way you would enforce it. But really the reason they're going to stay is because of the support and community framework we put around that person.
All right. Well, thank you, Rob. I think we should probably move on to our second topic now, which is that New Zealand First is proposing to remove the right to vote for permanent residents. Now, I didn't realise, but New Zealand is actually quite unique in allowing permanent residents to vote, one of only four countries, in fact. So why does New Zealand First think that it's appropriate to remove this right?
So first of all, in my perspective, from the very outset, I don't see it as removing a right because those people don't have a right to vote. That's the first part of it, right? So it's not just permanent residents. It's actually, we're unique in that we allow non-citizens to vote because it's not just people with permanent residency. So if you look at the legislation as it stands, actually any person in this country who's been here for more than 12 months on a non-temporary visa can vote in a general election. That's how loose the laws are. And it's a hanger back to when we were part of the British Commonwealth, where we had a race-based quota system in our immigration policy. We had an informal white New Zealand policy, and because of that, it was sort of any person from Britain could arrive here and have the same rights and entitlements. But we're not that kind of country anymore. We're
and
a multicultural.
And so now you're trying to change it because it's not just white people coming in. Is that what you're trying to say?
No, we're a multicultural country. In order to become a strong multicultural country, the likes of Singapore, when a person decides to become a citizen, that should mean something. So we're one of only five other countries that allow non-citizens to vote. The others are Ecuador, Malawi, Chile, and Uruguay. And even in those countries, the permanent residents who are able to vote have to be required residency in that country for at least 5 years, which is the same required residency for citizenship in New Zealand. So actually you can see it's actually quite unique. The argument is about removing a person's right. It's about making citizenship mean something in the 21st century, making sure that if someone wants to be here and become a citizen, it should take a bit of investment on their part, but once they become a citizenship, they should enjoy all the entitlements, freedoms and protections that it requires.
I guess that while those people are here, though, they are living here, they're paying taxes and they're using public services like schools and health.
Okay, well, let me just hold you up there, because for me personally, right, so I don't think a person's contribution to a country is just in economic terms. And I reject this idea. You take parties like the Association of Consumers and Taxpayers, like the ACT Party. I don't view people as just as economic cogs in a capitalist machine, right? Citizenship means so much more than that. Community means so much more than that. It's a moral obligation between people. It's a moral relationship between people. Our contribution to society and where we fit into it isn't just a matter of economical financial transactions. I might live and work in a number of countries around the world. That doesn't mean I have an entitlement to become a citizen there or vote there. Citizenship and being a Kiwi is something special, and that special thing doesn't have to be exclusive, but there should be a criteria for someone to join a family called Aotearoa New Zealand.
All right, so you're saying for those people who would be recipients of the rural visa, you're talking about welcoming them into rural communities, providing wraparound services, incorporating them into being part of the community, but not being able to vote, is what you're saying.
Well, because of the pathway we've created, eventually they will, if they want to.
Right. Now, I just guess with this, a concern is, does this not kind of feel like a step back? Because especially with New Zealand, I mean, we have our history of being quite liberal and being leaders in the world in terms of universal suffrage, with giving the right to vote to women. And so do you think that this kind of goes against our New Zealand culture in that way?
No, I don't. I think that voting in a general election and becoming a citizenship needs to mean something concrete and tangible. There's this idea at the moment that because we're so socially marble and interconnected, we can be anywhere, anyone in any place. We can have a timeshare in Wanaka, a bank account in the Virgin Islands, a passport for Estonia. We can be citizens of the globe. Peter Field can come over here for 12 days, and because he spends a couple of million on a property investment, he can become a citizen too. I reject that. As a New Zealand First member, I reject that. And as a believer in what this country stands for, I reject that. New Zealand is special. What encapsulates the idea of this nation is fairness, right? So for America, it's all about freedom. But for New Zealand, it's like, if you come to this country, you uproot yourself from your other corner of the world to come here at the very end of the world for a better life for yourself and your family. And when people make that commitment, we should enshrine that in legislation. And I think that if you've been here for 5 years and you've been put through the paces and you've made that commitment to become citizenship, that should be respected. And at the same time, if people are just dallying around the world on their super yacht, that's not the same thing. Just because they work here, just because they pay taxes here, or just because they've lived here for a couple of months out of a year.
I guess the final thing I would put to you just on these two issues of immigration, I'm quoting directly from your policy document here. It says that New Zealand First believes that everyone living in New Zealand legally should be entitled to the same legal rights no matter how long their time in New Zealand has been. I don't know if that was a typo, but it seems to me that permanent residents are here legally, as are people on visas. So how can you say that yet also deprive them of not only the right to vote, but if we're talking about that rural visa scheme, the freedom of movement as well?
So first of all, it's interesting you focus quite a bit on that permanent residency part, but it's actually a spectrum of a person's contribution and stay in the country, right? So on the one hand, we've got people on international visitor visa, then we've got the people on working holidays, that sort of temporary migration worker status, then we've got permanent residency, and then we've got citizenship.
They're all here legally though, so they fall
over. I don't dispute that for one moment. But in my mind, I would like a society in which it's very clear that there are people who are citizens and then there are people who are simply staying here or working or here for a short time. But we want a delineation between the people who are New Zealanders, they want to be here for a long time and they should have all the rights and privileges that entails. And you want a really well-defined nation that's socially coherent, socially cohesive. And for the people who simply want to have their timeshare here, have their super yacht here, that's fine. We'd love your investment. But in order to be a New Zealander, that has to mean something.
Right, thank you, Rob. I think lastly we'll turn on to this issue of defence. So you've got a range of policies around this, but some of them include, you know, incrementally increasing spending to defence to become 2% of the GDP in 2030, increasing the size of the reserve forces, and a 5% pay rise to all military personnel. So it's all very much about sort of growing and enhancing the actual defence force. And I just wondered how this ties into our modern understandings of what threats to national security are, especially, you know, having lived through a pandemic, what use are, I guess, guns and soldiers against a virus?
So the first is, there's a couple of things to tackle there. One is about where our military, and I say our military, but where our New Zealand Defence Force, because that's what it is, it's the defence of the realm, whether it be climate change, whether it be natural disasters, whether it be a global pandemic, it's the way in which we defend the interests of our nation. As a party, I would also include biosecurity within that remit. So our military and our defence force got seriously run down over the 9 years of National and 9 years of Labour because they failed to invest in it properly. They treated maintenance as a cost and therefore didn't spend enough on our basic infrastructure, the houses and the barracks that our people are living in, the equipment that they had. And then there's the flip side of it, which is, you know, I don't want to stereotype people, but there is a perception among some of the you know, sort of more liberal people that it's just a bunch of big macho guys with guns and they go into Afghanistan and they go full Rambo style. But it couldn't be anything further than the truth. The New Zealand Defence Force is the biggest industry training organisation in this country. They do a huge amount in terms of youth development. So in the course of this government, we've actually doubled the number of places in the limited volunteer service scheme from about 800 to 1,600. And what that's about is about taking young people who have fallen through the cracks. Every other social program hasn't necessarily worked for them, and it gives them that opportunity of that wraparound support that they weren't getting at home or in their own community, and allowing them to have the opportunity to have the structure and security within their home frame to upskill themselves and train and get some qualifications. The other side of it is obviously climate change. And I guess when it comes to defence policy, this is what we have to remember. When we're deciding what to buy or what to purchase or how to approach a conflict or a situation, the defence personnel are the experts. But in terms of what, in terms of how we navigate those conflicts, what our priorities are, that's for us as New Zealanders. So as a democratic population, we set the principles and the priorities of the Defence Force, and as an independent organisation, they deliver on those. So that's the first thing to remember. But in this term of government, one of the big changes has been the recognition of the role that climate change is going to pose for geostrategic implications right across the region. Be it resource scarcity and the implications for conflict from that, be it low-lying islands in the Pacific, and our already existing international obligations, whether it's peacekeeping overseas or responding to climate change disasters in the Pacific regions. And for that, you need a multi-purpose, multi-faceted task force. And that means you need your search and rescue aircraft, like the Poseidons. It means that you need dive and hydrographic vessels, like the HMZS Manawanui. And it means your personnel need the best technology, the best resources, and the best training to go overseas in harm's way, away from their families, do the best job they can, deliver on international obligations, keep people safe, but most importantly, come back home to their families.
All right, thank you, Robbie. Then that was going to be my next question I was interested to see, and it's good to see that New Zealand First does treat the climate crisis as a threat to national security. I just would wonder why we don't see a mention of that, however, under the specific defence sort of category in the policy document.
Well, the thing to remember is that the policy is what we're going to do, but that the climate change strategy that we developed under Ron Mark, that's what's been done. So now what will happen over the next term is that will inform everything we do, including the Defence Force Capability Plan. So we have the overarching plan of what we spend our in terms of infrastructure, in terms of equipment, and that climate change response and readiness strategy is going to inform every single step of that.
Okay. Thank you, Rob. I feel like our time may have elapsed and we might have to go to an ad break, but thank you so much for coming in here. In Studio 2, it's been, Studio 1, but in Studio as well, it's been a lot of fun. And good luck for the rest of your campaign.
Thank you very much for having me.
95 BFM Election Central.